Today's episode of Socially Democratic is presented to you by Dunn Street. Dunn Street partner with businesses, organisations, unions and social democratic parties across the globe to train leaders, develop community organising and engagement strategies to empower people to organise for change. And in 2021, Dunn Street will continue to work with folks that want to make a difference, inspire, give hope and enable leadership to achieve their shared purpose. To find out how you can partner with Dunn Street, hit us up at dunnstreet.com.au. Socially Democratic is also presented to you by Maurice Blackburn Lawyers. If you're passionate about working in the law and providing access to justice, then maybe Maurice Blackburn Lawyers is the place for you. And funnily enough, they're looking for a paralegal to join their class action team. So learn from a highly successful, collaborative and skilled team in an engaging culture and supportive environment by working at Maurice Blackburn. And the role is based in sunny Brisbane. And to apply, go to morrisblackburn.com.au/careers. Be part of change and fight for fair. Apply now. Hello and welcome to another episode of Socially Democratic, your weekly centre-left political and cultural podcast that dives into the progressive issues of the day and the people leading them from home and abroad. And on this week's episode, we are joined by Marcus Stewart, who is the co-chair for the First People's Assembly of Victoria. And Marcus comes on the show today to talk about the process of treaty that has been currently negotiated or about to be negotiated between the Aboriginal Victorian community, our First Peoples, and the Victorian government. So he'll talk about treaty, the truth-telling process and how that will fit into treaty. And indeed, there's been some huge announcements over the last 2 weeks in that space. So Marcus will be on here to talk about that and a hell of a lot more. So great to get Marcus on the show, and I hope you enjoy what he's got to say about a very, very historic and important step between black and white relations in Victoria. Don't forget to subscribe to the show via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher or Amazon or whatever you listen to in terms of your podcast app. And if you are following us on Apple Podcasts or if you use Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating and a review. And for all the most recent updates, follow Dunn Street on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and LinkedIn. Now let's get to today's episode. We're taping this one on a Friday afternoon on Wurundjeri land, and joining us on the line is the co-chair for the First Peoples Assembly of Victoria and a proud Ngarrindjeri man of the Tunnerong Nation, Marcus Stewart. Welcome to Socially Democratic.
Thanks for having me.
First question, how badly did I pronounce all of those place names just then?
You nailed them pretty well. Tunnerong's pronounced Tunnerung, not Tunnerong, but aside from that, you know, well played, well done.
Thank you. I spent at least an hour just practicing before we came on air, so I still got the last one wrong. My apologies. Now, you've made history as the first co-chair of the inaugural First Peoples Assembly, and we're going to talk a lot about the work that the Assembly is going to do around treaty and a bunch of other things in a moment. But before we do that, I want to get to know and our audience to get to know you a bit better. Talk us through your, I mean, who you are, where you're from, and talk us through your journey that led you to leading this historic movement towards treaty between Aboriginal Victorians and the Victorian government.
Yeah, sure. I'll just jump into my journey since you've given an explanation of who I am, how I identify. I guess Aboriginal activism advocacy is kind of in our blood. I had parents that have long worked in the space, and you know, if I talk about treaty, it's long been part of a round table or a dinner table conversation in my family, just really mapping out what it is, what it's like. We look at the Barunga Statement back in 89. I was young then. We look at the song Treaty, where we had everyone singing along but not understanding the words. And so, you know, I've often had an interest and a keen interest in what treaty is. But, you know, my career grew and evolved by watching how my parents were advocates for Aboriginal affairs and Aboriginal rights through the roles they had through, you know, through our community, through the Tunurung Nation. You know, Mum being an Aboriginal liaison officer in the corrections setting back when the Royal Commission was happening and the extreme racism she experienced and my dad experienced, it kind of puts a bit of fire and a bit of fight in the belly. So I always wanted to work in the space and give back and contribute. And so my my first line of employment and where I cut my teeth was in the child protection sector. And then going on to become a child therapist or a clinician. So I often worked in the early intervention end and then wanted to see what the tertiary end looked like, the corrections setting, and ended up working there as a cultural advisor in Corrections Victoria for a little while, understanding how difficult and challenging that that space is and, you know, how investment to create change in Aboriginal affairs needs to be heavily invested in the early years. So having these roles and working in sort of service delivery, you kind of understand, and, you know, having a sense of politics, because there were three things drummed into me growing up as a young fella, and that was my culture, it was the Collingwood Football Club, and it was the union movement. So three key and core values that were kind of, you know, I was beat around the head with, and you know, kind of really shaped my worldview and my political view. So understanding working in service delivery, you really figure out that's not where the change actually happens. There's bigger mechanisms moving. And so I took a keen interest to that. Started in a CEO role early in my career, in my late 20s, and which I failed miserably at, but probably learned most about myself and where I needed to grow and what I needed to do. But what I really understood there is, even though you're at the top of an organization or an Aboriginal organization, it's not where the change happens. So I went and did a stint in the public service to understand where, you know, if we're playing a game of chess, I didn't want to be playing with the pawns. I wanted the king and queens in my hand. And sometimes you get that unique opportunity at reform where you can do that through a policy setting. But it really sort of, you really keenly understand where change happens and, you know, where activism and advocacy meets the, you know, the political power of this state and this country. So, and then ended up in, you know, some political roles and led a traditional owner organization, which was My Nation Tunurung, then took on another role at the Federation of Victorian Traditional Owner Corporations, and now elected as the co-chair of the First Peoples Assembly, you know, entrusted by my community, entrusted by my chamber to, you know, lead this journey.
You mentioned some of the lessons you learned as a young bloke, when you had a CEO role. I'm interested to get a sense of what lessons did you learn from those experiences?
I guess the biggest one is I didn't really know what I was doing. I think, you know, over time, the lessons weren't instant, they were gradual, and they happened over time. I really understood and got a clear understanding of what my skill set was, where the gaps in my skills were. I mean, it's a hard thing to do sometimes, to actually sit in the mirror and have a, you know, kind of a hard conversation with yourself and identify that I'm pretty shit at this component of, you know, work, or I need to work hard at that. It wasn't easy, especially, you know, being young, being in a CEO role, the ego kicks in. But I think it was one of the biggest eye openers I had, and probably shaped a way forward. And I kind of shaped probably part of my worldview in that if we're going to achieve most, or how we achieve most for Aboriginal people, is not about individuals. This is about a collective movement. That's about bringing all our community along. So one thing I wanted to do coming out of that role is understand how the broader government system works, including the public service. And I felt that that was a real area of knowledge and a real gap. But also understanding, you know, was I an administrative purist or a policy purist? Probably not. But when I was, you know, just studying family therapy, one thing that really stuck with me was systems theories. And I think that really connects to, you know, how politics works. And I thought that was a real unique skill set that I had that I wanted to grow and I wanted to develop. And so really focused on, you know, getting my understanding of how this country and this state works.
You talked a little bit there before about identity, particularly your Aboriginal identity and your sporting and union identity. So I want to talk to you a bit about that to start with. I think if I was a rich man and didn't need to work, I'd do a PhD at a really expensive Ivy League university on cultural identity. So I find it fascinating and I find other people's identity really fascinating. So if we can have a chat about that and indulge me for one moment to sort of talk a bit about, I guess, my own identity. And when I reflect on my identity and how it shapes who I am, you know, I'm first generation Australian. My parents came from Glasgow, Scotland in the 1950s, but they are descendants of, you know, Irish Catholics. So we're fleeing, you know, famine and political oppression and all that kind of stuff. So I kind of grew up in that mix of an Irish Catholic, west of Scotland sense of identification. You know, so I'd say my cultural identity is Irish, but, you know, when I go back to Glasgow, it kind of feels like home in some respects. But at the same time, I'm very proud of the fact that mum and dad chose this great country to migrate and raise a family. But at the same time, I'm not jingoistic about being Australian, you know, like I don't celebrate Australia Day. I don't really identify, like say, like Anzac Day feels very foreign to me. My family came here in the 50s. So anything that was happening before then, it's kind of like there's a disconnect. So I wouldn't say there's a jingoism about my Australianism. However, at the same time, you know, I almost passed out when Harry Kewell scored the equaliser for the Socceroos against Croatia in Stuttgart in the 2006 World Cup. You know, so there's kind of there's conflicting feelings in me. And I think about the way I behave now and what shapes me, you know, sort of this, I guess I have a bit of an anti-establishment trait, which I think is kind of Irish. I'm a little bit impatient, which I think is a very Glaswegian thing. But I also have a kind of sort of aim for the stars, hit the moon kind of feel about the way I kind of do stuff, which I think is a very Australian sort of kind of outlook. So that's my mix. Now, you know, you're a first Australian. You're one of our First Nations people. I'm really interested to get a sense of, for you, your identity in balancing both being Aboriginal but also being Australian as well and all the things that are mixed up into, you know, 60,000 years of descendants on this land and then who you are today and how that shapes how you want to conduct yourself as a leader of that community but also is trying to bring together the sort of this black and white history of ours.
Yeah, no, it's a really good question because there are many of our mob who don't consider themselves Australians. I obviously identify through my Tanarong identity, through my mother's line. My father's line, you know, have been impacted through the stolen generations. My mum's line also has Scottish heritage, but more so from the East Coast in Dundee, where the Stuart name comes from. And my father, Irish, but his story is a little bit different in the sense that him and his siblings weren't a strong Irish Catholic family on his grandfather's side, but weren't allowed to eat in the house because of their identity, because of their Aboriginality growing up. So a really different sort of sense of connection that I would have with my Irish heritage. But I consider myself part of two nations, the Australian nation and my Tanarong nation, where I'm a Ngarial and Bullock man, which is my family group. So it's kind of, you kind of feel, well, I feel in a sense, my personal view is a dual citizenship, but also you spoke about that moment in 2006 from memory. You know, I felt the same sense of connection when that happened and that sense of pride. And I feel that connection, you know, to Australia, I feel that connection to Victoria, but I also feel a great sense of shame of how our people have been treated for 233 plus years. A sense of shame of how, you know, easily we dismiss our history, which is all our history. We all live on Aboriginal land, regardless if we're traditional owners or not. But that's where we see the opportunity for truth telling, because how do we all, and this is part of my sense of identity, how do we all create this this sense of connection, this sense of belonging of who we are, regardless if we're from, you know, Tunurong country, for example, or we're Victorians who live on Tunurong country. How do we then move forward? So it's something that there's that sense of in pride of what we felt, whether it was that that scoring shot from Kuehl or whether it was Cathy Freeman in 2000 winning the 400 meter gold medal. How do we create that sense of connection to our fellow Australian, our fellow Victorian, and that sense of pride in what's the oldest living culture in the world? And that's kind of what I'm about, because I think, how do we galvanize ourselves in this land to move forward together, to move forward in unity? And yeah, so I feel a great sense of pride in who my traditional owner, where my traditional owner connections are, how I identify as a First Nations person, but also, you know, to what my grandfather on my non-Indigenous side contributed to my Aboriginal nation. My great-great-grandfather, who was an Aboriginal man, was the first ever Aboriginal person to buy freehold land in this country in 1904 in Yay, which, you know, is an interesting concept given the time, and given that they were his father's traditional lands but had purchased it back under a Western system, and that can create, you know, I guess two lots of different discussions. But he was able to do so because he was the biggest fundraiser for returning vets from war, where his brothers had fought. So there's also that sense of connection to, you know, if we say Anzac Day, where I have family that were diggers, Aboriginal diggers, but weren't identified to, I think, 2012, or weren't acknowledged for their service. You know, great-great-uncle in protest returned his service medals because he wasn't awarded a piece of land when he returned, like every other a war veteran that come back here. And in response, the state forcibly removed his kids because he did protest. So there's a lot of sort of stories and histories that go back throughout my family. And, you know, good and bad, but I kind of feel a sense in pride in both. But I kind of feel a sense of divide, or a sense of shame and disconnect in a way that how our culture, our history as First Nations people have been so easily dismissed and so comfortably ignored. And I think we can do much better. I think we can do enormously better at how we connect and move forward.
And obviously the work of the Assembly and Treaty is such an important component of that. So tell us a bit about the Assembly. What's its job and what exactly is it?
Yeah, well, we're a representative democracy. We were set up to lead our community on our journey towards treaty. Back in 2018, there was a piece of legislation passed, which was the first in its history in this country, treaty legislation, which was to establish an Aboriginal representative body to start negotiating the key pieces of architecture for developing treaties within this country, within this state. In particular, our role is state focused. And we were set up in December 2019, which feels like a lifetime ago. We had our inaugural sitting in the upper house, which had mixed emotions and mixed reactions, given that that was at one point the federal parliament, and where laws to, I guess, destroy our culture, destroy our language, and remove our, and to tear our families apart were passed. So there was kind of a heavy feeling there, but there was a feeling and an emotion in there also that it was a good opportunity to turn that chamber black, having Aboriginal people in there representing our highest level of democracy and representation. So I was lucky enough then to be elected to our executive and then elected as a co-chair to lead us on this journey for the next, at that point, 4 years, now three. And our role is to develop a treaty negotiation framework with other key important pieces, including a treaty authority, which is the independent umpire, which can assure government negotiating good faith, and we can bring them back to the table, which we've never had such an entity like that, we recently signed off on a dispute resolution process, which is that legal instrument, which will fill the gaps until the authority's up, which is a true credit to government taking this seriously. But also a self-determination fund of where we can move the bureaucrats out of our lives and make decisions on where and how we fund treaty negotiations moving forward.
Did you look at other examples of treaties that have existed between First Nations and governments around the world as a sort of a guide or an inspiration or, you know, best practice?
Yeah, we did. We did. And I was also lucky enough to spend a bit of time in British Columbia, where in particular we looked at their contemporary treaty making, where I think it's around 26 years since they started that process. I think it might have been 93 from memory. Their first treaty that they'd struck was 2009, from as I understand. But that's like state treaty making. Their provinces, obviously British Columbia. It's very similar to what we're trying to achieve. So we look closely at what they were doing. Our chamber have an appetite to go down a hybrid model of statewide treaty, but also localized treaty. British Columbia provided a good example of what localized treaty meant and how it went, what could be achieved through them, I guess, their process.
What's the difference between localized and state level?
As we're sort of unpacking and understanding, because that's a brilliant question, it's what we saw as localized treaty making is traditional owner groups as sovereign nations negotiating their own treaties. That's how we'd see it in Victoria. That's how they've done it in British Columbia. A statewide treaty would be looking at more of the bigger questions. For instance, you know, if I'll use an example, the correctional setting, you know, what rights do Aboriginal people hold within how that's managed, how we actually start tackling the overrepresentation of Aboriginal people in that setting. It could be the piece that activates everything else as well, like the localized, but we don't have any examples of how that would work. That's what we're currently exploring right now. But we decided that a hybrid model was the most efficient way to go, which could address what we're trying to achieve here. We looked at the Treaty of Waitangi in New Zealand. Some amazing examples there, but it's a 100-year-old plus treaty. It's really hard to think, how do you actually build such a thing and such a treaty with such significance in a contemporary environment? But we also looked at, which isn't treaty focused, but we looked on political representation, and we looked at the Sami parliament in the through the Scandinavian countries, Norway, Finland, Sweden, and what their representative structure looked like since 1989 when it was established. And what were the similar parallels we could look at if we were, you know, say we wanted to get on a line of an Aboriginal parliament one day. So we have looked at examples internationally. We have looked at agreement making locally. For instance, we look at the Noongar agreement in Western Australia, which is pretty close to a treaty. It's pretty phenomenal what they've negotiated and achieved there. So there are numerous examples, but there's some, you know, some part of this journey, which is, you know, the first frontier where you've got to sort of go it alone and figure it out. And that's where we're at right now.
You mentioned that the Assembly is a democratically elected voice. Tell us about the power that comes with this body.
Yeah, we are. We're a hybrid model as well. We've got reserve seats for traditional owners, but we've got 21 elected seats from regions, which is similar to what we see in Parliament. There's a lot of power that comes in that, just as it is being an elected body, but also an enormous responsibility as well, because you're entrusted by your community to lead them on this journey. You know, you're entrusted to actually set out and improve the lives of our people who are basically wanting something. They don't want the status quo. They want to see something different, whether it's, you know, the struggle to get food on the table, but, you know, what can we actually achieve through this journey? And I think I've often described the responsibility and the pressure of the role, I guess, for all 31 leaders, as quite daunting, but the opportunity that we have in front of us has never been done before. You know, it's the first and real sense that I've seen for real self-determination, that, or in my lifetime at least, of what treaty can achieve. But we've got to understand as well that we serve a 4-year term. Our next iteration of the assembly will serve a 3-year term. And we're not going to achieve everything in that term, but we have to set the foundations and leave it on a stronger footing than we found it. And that's kind of the added responsibility that we feel we carry. There's a lot of power in that because we're setting the tone, we're carving out the new ground and or the new frontier, as I described earlier. But there's also, you know, we get one shot at this and we can't get it wrong. So in a sense, it's quite daunting. The responsibility is enormous, but there's a lot of power in being an elected voice and actually being able to hold government accountable to, you know, what we have seen as generations of disappointment.
The Assembly, as you said before, has been up and running for just over a year now. What's been some of the key milestones that you guys have achieved thus far?
I think the biggest, coming out of a chamber meeting yesterday, we sat for the first time this year. I think the biggest achievement is we have just signed off on a terms of reference, which we've been working with the government on for a truth and justice process in for the first time in this country's history, let alone state's history. I think we've seen roughly a little over 40 internationally, which is kind of still pinching myself to actually feel that this has actually happened. This is real. But and now we're out and we're advocating that we want to see this inquiry, which was agreed to in principle, that could be the shape it'll take, to have the powers of a royal commission to actually create true change and real change. And so pretty enormous 24 hours, as you could imagine. But also a couple of weeks ago, we signed off on the first piece of, I guess, the interim dispute resolution process, or the dispute resolution process, which was the first task we had to develop under the legislation. And now we've opened up the floodgates to negotiate the substantive matters, in particular the treaty negotiation framework. So that was an enormous achievement, and a credit to the leadership in on our chamber. And now everything, you know, it's game on.
Picking up that remark you mentioned before about truth telling, how's that going to fit in with the developments towards treaty?
I mean, that's a good question. And I think truth telling can really offer the why to what treaty is. It's often hard to describe, you know, what you want to achieve through treaty, what it could be. But truth telling really flips the momentum now that what has happened in this state's history can no longer be denied. We can actually tell the true side of history. And that's something that should be able to galvanize us as Victorians and as traditional owners in Victoria. I think it can really, I guess, really shed light on our history, what's happening from a contemporary point of view. So for instance, why are Aboriginal Victorians 10 times more likely to die die 10 years younger, than their fellow Victorian? Why does Victoria have the highest level of overrepresentation in the child protection system in this country of Aboriginal children? But also, what are some of the amazing stories of our history? You know, our language, we look at the World Heritage listing of Gunditjmara on Gunditjmara country, Budjibim. We look at the 20,000 plus year old rock art in Euroa on Tunurong country, on my country. You know, there's some amazing stories, there's amazing history in this state alone. And we see it as an opportunity to galvanize this state and create that level of connection and belonging that we all move forward together, and that we're a better state forward. We create a better Victoria.
Do you think the Victorian public is ready for this truth telling?
We saw during the Deadly Questions campaign, which is a government campaign. It wasn't run by us. But what we saw was a significant appetite for Victorians to want to know more, to want to understand what the history was. But what was clear is they want to do it at their own pace. They don't want it thrown in their face or slapped around the head. They want to be able to dip their toe in the water, not have to dive in straight away. And I think what's important about this journey is that that's exactly what it is. You know, the door's open and people can engage at their own pace, but the beauty is it will create, as I said earlier, a better Victoria and a galvanized Victoria. And I think what we learned from Deadly Questions is now's the time. We've just seen the launch of Deadly and Proud, which is the second or phase two to that campaign. But I think Victoria are absolutely ready for a truth-telling process and are ready for treaty. And now's the time where we can work together to actually deliver something significant and something substantial, because treaty won't just benefit traditional owners in Victoria or Aboriginal Victorians. It'll benefit all Victorians. And if I go back to the example I mentioned earlier around British Columbia, through treaty making, there was a Deloitte study done not too long ago that we saw a $7 billion increase into the British Columbian economy that saw the direct beneficiaries of that. The direct beneficiaries of the treaty making there. So they've seen a growth in their economy, which benefited First Nations people in British Columbia, British Columbians and Canadians more broadly. So that's ultimately what treaty can achieve. And everyone will be better off for what we can actually deliver here. And that's what we're saying, you know, get on board. Let's walk together.
How much does education play a part in that mission? I was thinking about this morning when I was sort of getting ready for the podcast, and I was thinking about back to my high school education. I'm sure the curriculum has changed substantially since 1988, but I know that when I went through high school, we did Aboriginal history once, and it was in year seven, and I don't think we touched it again throughout the next 6 years of my secondary education. I reckon we covered, and not to sound like I'm bashing the Anzacs again, but I think we covered the First World War on three separate occasions in year seven, year nine, and I think I did it in my year 12 VCE. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I'm sure it's changed since then, but you know, surely that our curriculum needs to kind of put some greater emphasis on the history of our First Nations peoples. I mean, where are we with that?
It has to be. It's critical. And that's what we hope that truth-telling can achieve. We saw that commitment under the Rudd government. We still aren't seeing that rolling out, but it's critical. There was never one piece of Aboriginal curriculum in my whole schooling life. We never studied it once. Plenty of times the curriculum was around Captain Cook, which I remember getting kicked out of the room or out of the classroom one day for reminding the teacher that he was a lieutenant when he arrived on these shores, not a captain. But
I love that.
Never once had the opportunity for Aboriginal curriculum through the schooling, through the schools I attended, both primary and high school. But it's critical. Education is single-handedly one of the most important tools we have to bring our fellow Victorian along and to understand what our history is. And it's the oldest living culture in the world. It'd be amazing if we could teach this in our schools. I know from my time at Tunnerong, we started running a language curriculum, Tunnerong language curriculum, out of Buxton Primary School, which you know, they loved. But you know, imagine we could be able to teach language around the state. Obviously, we want to see language taught for our people as well, because there's many of us don't speak fluent language, but something also we can share. But I think education is critical, and an Aboriginal curriculum is would be amazing if we could achieve that.
Picking up on that point about language, I know it's another thing. It's an extension of identity, isn't it? And it's something that I've noticed that when I've gone over to New Zealand for work, particularly in the Labor Party circles and on the left, I'm sure this is, I don't think this is a political thing at all, but I have no experience of it in outside of these gatherings, but both Māori and white New Zealanders there is a, I find that there is a commonality that exists, and it's a link through the language, where there is a great level of respect paid. If you go to a Labor Party meeting over in New Zealand, or if you go to their national conference, language plays a part in that, and it is shared by both Māori and white or non-Māori New Zealanders. I think it's a great leveler and a great ability to create common purpose. And I just think that that is something that is really missing here in Australia, and a great opportunity for us to do that. Look, I get that, you know, there's a lot of languages in the broad Aboriginal and Indigenous and Torres Strait Islander community, but surely there is something that we can use there as a way of, you know, bringing people together. Is there, like, you've just given that example before about your own language up in Buxton, which is great. And I think I heard someone, we've had previous guests on the show before, talked about they're actually introducing it, maybe is it Northcote High School as well? Yeah. But, you know, where are we in terms of the language development?
I guess you look at traditional owner groups around Victoria, they're all at their sort of different stages. If I use my own traditional owner group, we've got our own language dictionary. We've got an app that you can access. We've been able to interpret it across to Auslan, which is also on the app. I think it's called Auslan. I can't remember. But basically, we've also got a... I forgot the name of it, but basically a grammar book. So you can actually start looking at how you structure your sentences and whatnot. So it's pretty phenomenal where we've got, and different mobs are at different stages, but, you know, our language is critical to our culture, and it's single-handedly what colonization prioritized in targeting to destroy, along with separation from land and separation of families. So it was a common tactic used across the world to separate First Nations, or basically to colonize First Nations lands. But I think it'd be amazing if we got to a point in time where we could share and exchange language with our fellow Victorian. It was taught and spoken in schools, and it was a common dialogue or dialect amongst the Victorian community, like we see in New Zealand.
Where are we up to right now in the treaty process?
Yeah, it's a good question. We're, as I said earlier, we've just signed a interim dispute resolution process, which will provide, I guess, I've been on the record of describing it as the great equaliser. It'll keep government honest, it'll hold them accountable, and make sure they engage in this process in good faith. And that's not saying they haven't, but it gives us a legal instrument to keep them honest during this this process. We're about to dive into some big conversations and big negotiations around the treaty negotiation frameworks, which will be huge. So we anticipate an enormous year ahead of us. On top of that, the truth-telling process, which I think is going to be it's going to be confronting, but it's also going to be probably one of single-handedly the most significant process that we run in our community. And I mean community is in our broader Victorian community, to really, I guess, start that process of reconciling, that process for Aboriginal communities of healing. So it's pretty exciting right now.
This is almost like the "where do you want to be in 5 years" kind of question. But, you know, what's your aspirations for treaty? What does success look like down the track?
It's a really good question. I think the best way to answer that is it's not going to be up to me, even though, you know, I sit in I carry a senior role, senior responsibility in this, but it's certainly not up to me what these outcomes will look like. I think what's critically important is that whatever treaty will be, it'll be a community-driven outcome by our people, for our people. But it has to improve the lives of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in Victoria. It has to be, you know, it's an old cliche that I've used, but it has to be the tide that raises all ships. You know, we see the closing the gap data growing and growing, and we see governments continually come out spinning it although the outcomes are getting worse, they're trying to claim that they're getting better. So we need to start looking at, why is this disadvantage growing? How do we improve it? And how do we underpin the inherent rights of traditional owners in the state of Victoria?
I mean, I guess there has to be, I'm assuming there's a practicality to the treaty, right? It's not just a, one of the challenges for the campaign for an Australian Republic is it's not grounded in, I don't think they see, how's it going to impact directly on my life? It can be sometimes seen as a bit too symbolic.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there is plenty of important symbolism in treaty, but where's the practicalities here for Aboriginal people in negotiating a treaty with the government?
If we think about the Swanson people, for example, in British Columbia, southwest of Vancouver, they saw resistance from British Columbians in their area around their local lands of what it would mean for them. What does a treaty settlement mean? You know, does that make life more difficult for them? It seems a bit symbolic and a bit political. Like, what as individuals are they getting out of this? And we saw, you know, through numerous dialogue between the Swanson people and local business holders, the people living in that area, they were getting 12-month leases on their ag lands. They ran agribusinesses. And we saw joint ventures. We saw micro businesses. We saw the Swanson people basically going into agreements of 20-year ag leases to actually support longevity and continuity in their business. We saw them become an enormous employer on their local lands of both Swanson people and non-First Nations people in British Columbia. That's the significant opportunity that treaty offers, not only to, in our example, Victorians or traditional owners, but actually more broadly Victorians. If I use Tunurong, for example, aside from Mitchell Shire, I think we're one of the biggest employers in central Victoria of both, you know, traditional owners, Tunurong people, Aboriginal people, but also Victorians, because that's where our investment will be. If we settle a treaty, we'll see job growth in our local region. We'll see employment opportunities, obviously. We'll see opportunities for joint ventures with local business through natural resource management, management of parks. And we're already seeing that through, some of the traditional owner group settlements that we've seen in Victoria. And treaty will sort of, I guess, enhance that, empower that. But I think that's what, it's always hard to describe what an outcome of treaty would be. What does it mean for individuals, as whether we're traditional owners, Aboriginal Victorians, or non-Indigenous people? But I think we'll see significant growth in jobs. For instance, for us, a priority is how do we take, and we saw it with the Swanson people, if we've got a lot of our young people leaving school early, how do we get them and build life skills? You know, if we're developing an agribusiness, for example, or we're managing country through natural resource management. So we will see a direct benefit for all Victorians, not just traditional owners and Aboriginal Victorians.
I have noticed that you and your big hat have been plastered all around Melbourne at the moment as part of the Deadly and Proud campaign, which you mentioned earlier on in the show. What's the purpose of this new iteration of the campaign?
This campaign is going to be significant because it's connected to treaty. It starts the dialogue around what treaty means, what this could be. And it's targeted at our fellow Victorian to start understanding. For instance, what does the word deadly and proud mean? And that's where we've seen some of the commercials on TV now. And we've seen some of, unfortunately, me with my big hat plastered around billboards. But it's really to open up that dialogue and start building that understanding of what our culture is, to absolutely showcase Aboriginal stories of what we all can be proud of, you know, living on Aboriginal land or being connected to Aboriginal land, that emphasize, showcase Aboriginal stories from around this state. And, you know, people can check out www.deadlyandproud.vic.gov.au, I think it is, and check out the stories. They're pretty phenomenal. They're powerful. And we're going to see that campaign roll over the next 3 months, but it's a hook into treaty. It starts connecting that why are we on this journey towards treaty in Victoria? What can this actually mean? What is the oldest living culture in this country? Let's start to understand what these stories are, how we connect with them. So I think it's pretty exciting, aside from the big hat and the unfortunate event of people having to look at my face on billboards. But I think it's going to be a successful campaign, building on what we saw in Deadly Questions. You know, starting to engage the appetite that Victorians have of wanting to know more, wanting to connect to what this journey towards treaty is and understand what they can do and how they can contribute. So I think it'll lead well into a truth-telling process if we successfully land a truth-telling process. And it's a bit of a watch this space for now.
What does deadly mean?
Deadly is a word that we use in our community to describe brilliant, it's awesome, it's great. So we'll often describe something as, yeah, that's deadly. Not in the term most associated with in Western society. It's something that we attribute to, you know, oh, that's great, that's brilliant, fantastic. So it's we use the term deadly, and the Deadly and Proud campaign is around how can our fellow Victorians be deadly and proud just like we are?
So how can fellow Victorians be deadly and proud just like you guys are? What's a way in which the broader community can get involved in this process or support it?
People can check out our website, www.firstpeoplesvic.org. Not that that's going to make you deadly and proud, but it's going to give you some information around our journey to date and where we're sort of taking this, this what will you describe as, you know, as form part of our activism, this rhetoric into reality, which will be treaty, which will benefit all Victorians, not just us. Get engaged in the truth-telling process. That's going to be, you know, significant. And we hope that achieves, you know, enormous outcomes in improving the lives of Aboriginal people. We can now share the true side of our history as Victorians, not the one side that's often been dismissed. So people can check out our website. They can engage in the Deadly and Proud campaign or their website. But they can also just stay informed, have conversations with their neighbours, their friends, their family. It's significant what's happening now, but it's the right thing to do. So now's the opportunity to get engaged, stay informed, and stand with us and walk with us on this journey, because it's the greatest opportunity we've seen for true reconciliation.
The process of treaty, Victoria's leading the way in this. Is there a level of pressure that the community's feeling about the work that you guys are doing, or is it you embracing the trailblazing aspirations of being the first to secure a treaty in this on this island continent?
Yeah, it's probably not appropriate for me to disclose some of the advice that I've received from our from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people outside of Victoria around the process, but we've got the eyes of a nation on us. We get one shot at this to get this right. And to put it more diplomatically, you know, many of our fellow brothers and sisters have said to us, don't stuff it up, we're watching. And probably not as many diplomatic or with less diplomatic language, but yeah, absolutely. We've got one shot at this. We're hoping to land the first ever truth-telling process in this country's history, let alone this state's history. That'll be phenomenal. It'll be enormous. It's history-making. And we're a long way ahead on our journey towards treaty if we look at where Queensland are at and where the Northern Territory are at. Unfortunately, the South Australian government pulled the pin on the traditional owners in South Australia, which is devastating. But we hope they'll come back to the table, and we hope to see treaty making happening through every state in this country.
Well, you are right. It is indeed historic, and it's going to be incredible to watch you guys go through this process and journey over the coming weeks, months, and years. Marcus Stewart, thanks very much for taking time to come on the show, and we wish you the best of luck with the work that you're doing.
Thanks for the opportunity.